All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. Before we begin, you'll notice that Justice Pfeiffer is not here. He's detained in traffic and will be joining us shortly. Our first case is 11-538, the State of Ohio versus Vaughn Clark Davis. For the appellant, we have Mr. Comp.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. I would like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. This case comes to this court with a very unique and extraordinary circumstance. We're here in 2013 related to a third death sentence, which issued in 2009 via a three-judge panel when the original jury waiver was in 1984 for a crime that occurred in 1983. The other unique or extraordinary circumstance is that this case is here for the third time. The first time this court sent it back because the trial court committed an error by considering non-statutory aggravating circumstances when it imposed a death sentence. This, as this court noted, this violated United States Supreme Court authority and the express terms of the Ohio death penalty statute. It went back and this court necessitated a resentencing or a sentencing hearing. The second sentencing hearing, another system failure occurred. The trial court at the second sentencing hearing, as held by the Sixth Circuit, failed to allow the submission of mitigating evidence. And that led to a third sentencing hearing. And those unique and extraordinary circumstances provide a framework for the issues that I'd like to focus the court on today. The first one is the failure to allow the third sentencing to proceed before a jury.
And Counsel, let me ask you. The guilt phase of this case was never overturned or remanded, correct?
That is correct.
So the waiver attached for the guilt phase, the waiver of a jury?
It remains intact. I mean, yes.
Yes.
The errors that were found both times relate solely to the sentencing phase.
And do we not have case law that says that the defendant is not entitled to a jury for the sentencing?
You do, but this is a very unique circumstance. And I think that case law, that case law is premised upon the statute. And I don't think the statute contemplates a second bite of the apple and a third bite of the apple for the state to get it right. I think the statute contemplates when you waive a jury, and there's another unique factor, but I'll address your question up front, but I think there's another factor that sort of influences the response to this. So the presumption is when you waive your jury, you're giving up one of the big three, right? The right to testify, the right to plead, or the right to take your case to a jury. It's one of the big three constitutional rights that any defendant has. And when you're doing that, you know, the presumption is what I'm giving up, I will get a constitutional proceeding in return. And the state failed one time, and it failed a second time. And critically, where those failures occurred are in the actual sort of the meat of what's going on at a sentencing hearing, the weighing process, the calculation that goes on. So one of the unique factors of this case is that you're keeping that the trial court in this case, and I think this is fair, it goes beyond what this court has considered before, is when the very thing that you waived to receive has failed you twice, are you forced to take it a third time?
Counsel, if I may ask, Don, I'm having trouble with your concept that if we were to agree with you that because this is a unique case, therefore we may ignore the jury waiver and let him bring in a jury some 20 years hence, wouldn't logic dictate that he can then waive the jury waiver and say, let's start again?
Waive the jury waiver as to
altogether, and say this is not working out too terribly well for me, and I'd like to start again.
As to the sentencing, or
as to the trial.
In
other words, what is so unique about the sentencing phase that we would depart from the statute that is different from just saying the waiver's invalid?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. As Chief Justice O'Connor's question indicated, the errors that have occurred don't reach back into the guilt phase. So I think what we're talking about is what the remedy should be in these unique circumstances as to the penalty phase. So he's not technically convicted under this court's authority because the sentence hasn't passed, but the error did not occur at the guilt phase, so his jury waiver would not, we're not saying that the jury waiver should reach back.
That's my question specifically, is that are you saying that any time this court reverses a sentence, that it is time to open the door and take a look at the jury waiver?
No, not every occasion, because the majority of the jury waivers are under the new statute. So when the jury waiver is occurring under the 2929026B, the presumption is that the trial attorneys are informing their client of what could occur and what cannot occur. What we're saying is this is a unique and extraordinary circumstance which this court has never considered before, and the statute simply doesn't contemplate. When the legislature's passed this statute and when this court previously has passed on these issues, certainly not the court wasn't thinking in the back of their
so
mind.
So the question is, are we going to apply the statute to your client's set of circumstances? This is a statutory interpretation.
And correct, and we don't think the statute covers a circumstance coming back again and again and again.
Well, again, what's your basis for that? You say that the quid pro quo, I'm giving up my right to a jury so that I trust that the three-judge panel is going to give me a constitutionally sound court proceeding, correct?
Correct.
And if they fall down on the mitigation phase of my trial, then the statute shouldn't apply to me. That's what you're saying.
I think that goes, I think, two responses. One, the quid pro quo in this case, if you look at the jury waiver, was a three-judge panel to be composed of three particular judges. So the state can no longer live up to their end of the bargain. And that was the second half of the response to your earlier question that I was going to get to until Justice O'Neill's question. So we haven't got, and they cannot deliver, what our client waived his jury for.
You're saying your client waived a jury only because there were three specific judges that were going to hear that case.
If you look at the appendix to our brief, page 59 of the appendix, the three-judge panel, and this is unique to this case. This is not, the typical case, what Justice O'Neill has discussed and what this court has addressed in the past is a waiver to a three-judge panel. And you understand when you're making that waiver that can change. The waiver specifically in this case, and it's at page 59 of the appendix, is a three-judge panel, and then it includes the language, to be composed of, and it lists the three judges. This was not an issue the first time this case sent it back because those three judges were on the bench.
Although no statute gives the right to the defendant to select three judges of his choosing, correct?
Oh, absolutely not, and we're not suggesting that. But that's a factor when the judges are randomly drawn, right? And it goes, I'm dating myself, but for instance, there's now a rule in Franklin County, just as there's a rule in Hamilton County. What was happening is, they get the jury, they'd sort of venue shop. They, waive jury, see the three judges, and if they didn't like them, they'd withdraw the jury, and then they'd do it again, and, the decks would be reshuffled, and they changed the rule so that, these are the three judges you're going to get when you change.
But regardless, the statute itself under 06B, and you said the intent doesn't seem to be there. You said, however, the statute says that if there's a nullification in the sentencing, if the offender was tried by a panel of three judges, that panel, and then the language, or if necessary, a new panel of three judges shall conduct the hearing. So to me, it seems as though the statute specifically applies here when there's a nullification in the sentencing. If there's been a three-judge panel and that panel doesn't exist, you have the right to another three-judge panel.
But there's been a nullification here of a second sentencing. We're talking about a second sentencing, and that's what makes this unique.
There's no limiting action or limiting language in that statute. You want us to impose that because this is the third opportunity that takes us out of the statute, and the statute only envisions, in essence, one bite of the apple.
Correct. And it's driven by, this is a door that if it's open, it opens only for the appellant. This is not an error that you've seen before and you're going to see again. This is a very unique circumstance. You're talking about a jury waiver that was premised upon three particular judges. The state can no longer meet their end of the bargain. You're talking about a system failure, which was the three-judge panel. And so the third time, I'm preparing for that. I haven't been in front of this court for a very long time. In fact, I think the last time I argued here was in Justice Pfeiffer's first year here. And I was watching oral arguments to prepare for this. And questions that came out from this bench were, isn't the defendant asking for a second bite of the apple? Well, what we're saying is the state shouldn't get a third bite of the apple. That the jury waiver is a very significant right. There's nothing in 2926B that limits us in this circumstance.
Counsel, once you make the decision to proceed with a three-judge panel, you don't get the opportunity to change your mind. Is that correct? The trial opens, you've got your three-judge panel. You don't get to then say, you know what, I've changed my mind, I want a jury now.
Once it starts, the statute allows you to withdraw it until the commencement of trial.
Correct.
You're absolutely
so
correct.
So the trial commences, and you are in agreement that you are not allowed to then, once the trial commences, to say, now I want a jury, I've changed my mind.
Yes. That's an accurate statement.
Okay, and it is envisioned in a case such as this, there is a guilt phase and a mitigation phase.
Correct.
And the distinction here, the only distinction, is that you're arguing the statute never envisioned three opportunities for the mitigation phase to occur.
Again, the presumption is when you waive your jury, you're going to receive a constitutional process, and the state failed twice.
I would probably agree with you if the guilt phase had been reversed, set aside, but the conviction, decision with regards to the guilt was not. It was not go back and do the whole thing over again. It was only the mitigation phase.
Well, that in a case like this, that's the main event.
Well, I understand I understand, from your perspective, yes. But there's no provision that I can see that would carve out the exception that you're asking for.
Because it's not contemplated by the statute, obviously there is no facial provision in 2929-006B that covers this circumstance. But there's also no prohibitory language in this circumstance that would prohibit this court from recognizing an exception in this case, especially when we're talking about the errors in this case were caused by the trial court. So you're not appellant. Right. Some of these cases go back for new sentencing because an appellant, the defense attorney made a mistake or the prosecutor committed error and defense counsel didn't object. So you're looking it through the lens of ineffective assistance of counsel. And obviously a trial attorney's conduct or misconduct is attributed to the defendant. So this is a circumstance where through no fault of his own, these cases went back for three different sentencings.
Counsel, I guess that's why I'm still troubled by my earlier question. Are you saying that's because this is the third round? Would this also apply in the second round? And if we were to accept that, aren't you asking us to open the door that one who has waived a jury and he's been tried by a 3-judge panel, and sits down at the table with his counsel and say, well, that didn't go too well, let's bring in a jury?
No, I don't think it opens the door, provides the slippery slope that you're describing. I think one, it goes back to, in the cases now under the new statute, the client is fully apprised. You know, again, this is 1984, right? And the waiver occurred in 1984. So, you know, State versus Penix wasn't out there. All these changes to the statute weren't out there. So a defendant now who makes the jury waiver is fully cognizant, or the presumption is they're fully informed by their trial counsel of what may or may not happen given what goes on at the sentencing. So a distinguishing factor, and I think this is critical, and this is why it doesn't open the door, is if you look at the appendix, page 59, this waiver was to a 3-judge panel to be composed of.
Counsel, that's not exactly what the waiver says, though, is it? It talks about the waiver, it says consisting of, and it names the 3 judges, but it then also goes on to say, I waive to a panel of 3 judges later on. It doesn't say only to the judges and naming the 3. I can see where you're interpreting the waiver that way, but it can also be interpreted that your client understood it was a panel. These happened to be the 3 judges that were going to hear the case, but the waiver says, I waive to a panel of 3 judges.
I'm reading, quote, waive my right to trial by jury and elect to be tried by a court to be composed of 3 judges.
And go to the next paragraph.
Consisting of judges Henry Brewer, William Stitzinger, and John R. Moser.
And the following paragraph then refers to a panel.
But it's... I mean, if you look at the totality of the document, that clearly is referencing the paragraph before.
But you did not select the judges, correct?
Pardon me?
You need your microphone.
You did not select the judges.
No. But
they were rolled. They were rolled.
Yes.
You got the names, and those names were merely inserted into this entry. Clerically.
This was an entry prepared by, if you look at the bottom left-hand side, prepared by the prosecutor's office, signed off by the client, and signed by the presiding judge.
But there was no negotiated agreement that it was only these 3 men who could hear this case, correct? They were just rolled, and their names were then put into this entry.
Put into this agreement. And then that agreement is echoed in the actual jury waiver where the 3 judges are named again. And that's the basis of the waiver. I want these 3 judges. This is what the panel is going to be composed of. It would be forum shopping if he could say, all right, I don't want these 3 judges, let's re-roll. You know, he made his decision based on, this is where my mitigation is at this point, this is where the aggravation is, these are 3 judges that I can live with.
Well, let me ask you, at the end of the guilt phase, and then you go to the mitigation phase, obviously, at that point, your client could not have, at that point, reneged on his waiver and asked for a jury, correct?
Correct. Back in 1984, no, he could not have.
Okay. And nothing in the law has changed since then, so currently that he could not do that either.
If he went back and he waived jury, yes. I mean, somebody today down the block
still
in Franklin
couldn't
County
it.
Couldn't do it halfway through.
Okay, but that's what you're asking us to do now, because it's as though the first several mitigation phases didn't occur. We're back to a brand new mitigation phase.
Why we're there is important.
It's because the first two obviously were defective.
Because of trial court errors. So what you would be enforcing is, we're not going to give you the judges because the state can't provide them, and we're going to force you into a process that has failed twice already. And we're not even going to consider that this 1984 jury waiver was premised upon these three judges being available, and now we have all this new mitigation that can't even factor into the equation of whether or not you're going to waive a jury.
But Mr. Kump, your argument is you want the three judges who weren't able to do it properly.
That's a component of our argument. But it's also...
It's been done twice, but incorrectly by the judges, and you want them back. That's your argument to us.
No, he wants a jury...
He's been sentenced twice during the penalty phase by three judges, one of whom is dead, but twice done incorrectly. And your argument to us is, I want those judges back again. They're the only ones I want. That's what I'm hearing,
we want a jury. That's what we think the only fair and equitable way to determine a sentence is to have a
what
jury.
What is the prejudice to having three different jurists conduct the penalty phase?
Because who the judges are impacts whether you want to go to a jury or whether you want to go to the three judges. And let's use, for example, the U.S. Supreme Court. And let's say they did a roll, and the roll is Scalia, Thomas, and Alito.
Well, you don't know that you wouldn't get...
And it's not that they're
you
fair.
You don't know that you wouldn't get judges that would be more fair to your client.
But I think my advice to my client would be much different if I...
It's hard for me to hear you when you're talking during my questions.
I apologize.
You don't know that you would get judges that would be more fair to your client than these three, do you?
But it's not whether you get three judges of a certain fairness, it's whether or not I want these three judges to hear it versus
a jury
to consider.
Well, you've selected three jurists who have twice imposed capital punishment on your client.
We didn't select them. They were
You agreed to, and you're asking us that those are the ones that you want.
That's a component of our argument. We want a jury. It's a component of the fact that they can't deliver what they specifically promised for.
So if these three judges were still available, would you be here arguing this? Wouldn't you be arguing, we don't want this panel of three judges, we want a jury because these three gentlemen were not able to get it right twice, and we have no confidence in their abilities?
Well, we're asking for a jury. We're saying this is such a unique circumstance.
But answer the hypothetical that I'm, giving you. If they were available, the exact three judges were available in 2009.
Absolutely not.
What would you?
That we would attempt to waive the jury and
you would still waive the jury?
I'm sorry. We would attempt to withdraw the jury waiver. We would attempt to have it go in front of the jury.
In front of the jury. So it's not a question of these three exact men that you want on this panel. You're saying because of the three, the multiple opportunities that were not contemplated by the statute only should apply to, one bite at the apple, not the three bites at the apple. So you're not really making an argument that because I can't get the three members of the jury or of the panel that we originally waived it with regards to, that we're entitled to withdraw our waiver. That's not your argument.
That's an aspect of it, but that's not the core.
That can't be your argument because you can't argue, as Justice O'Donnell said, with credibility that we want these three folks who couldn't get it right on two occasions, and now we want to give them a third opportunity to not get it right.
That's the flux we're in. All right, what we're saying is, we're saying in order to sustain that jury waiver, this court's looking back temporally, as did the Court of Appeals and as did the trial court, to 1984. They're saying that's the critical component. And so what were those three judges? I mean, that's why we're focusing on that, because we're stuck with what's at 1984. I think that's wrong. I think that violates Duncan versus Louisiana. If the statute doesn't prohibit this, and there is no prohibitory language in this unique procedural posture, Duncan versus Louisiana, if the statute's read to prohibit the jury in this case, we think there's a violation of Duncan versus Louisiana. This is a very unique circumstance where it's not contemplated by the statute, and this court can carve out a remedy for it. for this. The reason I'm focusing on these three judges is because every time we talk about with the change of circumstances, there's new mitigation, mitigation that touches upon the sole aggravating circumstance, and that changes the calculus is when you sit down with your client and say, this is what, should we take this to a three-judge panel or should we take this to a jury? And the reason I focus on those three judges is that's, we're stuck in 1984, 25 years ago. I was a junior in high school. This waiver survived five different presidents.
Counsel, you were obviously a young man when you were here last.
Yes.
You have the second proposition of law. You haven't talked about the panel of judges erred in not considering and giving certain weight to certain mitigating evidence. And I want to combine that with the question, this court has to do its own independent weighing again.
Correct.
We are now almost 30 years removed from the crime. The attitudes about the appropriateness and the use of the death penalty have changed. You haven't addressed that. Are we bound to follow what the prior versions of this court determined on that question, or is that a fresh look?
Absolutely a fresh look. You're not bound by what the court's previously determined. I think when that review is being conducted and when you look at, again, the trial court here gave no weight to mitigation, and that's simply not allowed under Lockett and Eddings. Once something's found to be mitigating, it has to be given some weight. You add zero to a scale, if you use the metaphor that the trial court used, the scale's not going to move.
Well, your analysis in Prop 2 is that they didn't even consider, and this is after having been reversed a couple of times, that they didn't even consider the factors that this court discussed in the prior opinions.
And I think in the context that you brought in the appropriateness review, obviously that's de novo. And one thing to keep in mind is I think it was foreshadowed by the Sixth Circuit and certainly was discussed by Justice Wright in the dissent the second time, that there almost appears to be sort of a presumption of death in this case. And I think, we have objective evidence of that with the disparate treatment and mitigation. As the mitigating evidence is getting stronger and stronger over time, and it's being given less and less weight or no weight at all. And I think that really underscores.
When you say it's getting stronger over time, you're referring to his good behavior in prison?
Good behavior in prison and the clinical psychologist that testified was able to give testimony regarding a B3 mitigator. So a critical component is, the daughter of the victim from the first crime, the sole aggravating circumstance in this, had reconciliation with Mr. Davis and forgave him. And that's powerful mitigating evidence that was given little weight. So when you're doing your appropriateness review, which has to be de novo, and it's the only appropriate way to do it is de novo, I mean, there are compelling mitigating factors here that could compel. In this case, with this sole aggravating factor, and given that he is not a problem in prison, 30 years and one write-up on a very, very minor thing, honor pod the entire time, reconciliation with the victim from the first crime, that is powerful, powerful mitigation.
Mr. Comp, I wanted to understand if the panel says that they are assigning no weight to something, are you suggesting that by assigning no weight, they are not considering the mitigation on
yes.
a particular point?
Yes, it's not.
So you're saying the only way to consider mitigation on a particular point is if there's some weight assigned to that factor?
Correct. And I think Eddings Eddings talks about once you find something to be relevant mitigating evidence, you can't assign it no weight. It has to be something.
Do you have a support for that, that no weight means no consideration?
I can, when I get, I have the Sixth Circuit cites Eddings for that proposition, and I can provide that cite to you when I get up in rebuttal, which I have about 50 seconds left. If there are no further questions.
Counselor, Justice Lansker has brought something to my attention. I'm reading from your brief, though. I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You say one may not give no weight to mitigating evidence. May not give no weight. That's
right.
A double negative. So that means we must give weight?
Yes. If there's mitigation, if it's relevant mitigation, it must be given weight.
So you're saying a panel or this court cannot say that something they look at and they say, I'm just giving that no weight. It has no weight. I can't say that in your view?
Under Eddings and Lockett, no, you cannot.
So it's not persuasive. That's what the court is saying. When I give it no weight, I am not persuaded by this evidence.
Once, if you go back to Stephan says a court can give no weight to something that's not mitigating. But once it's mitigating, once it's on the scale, it has to be given some weight. If we're using the metaphor of the scales, which the trial court did, and let's say we have, you know, seven mitigating factors, and we're going to assign them no weight, well, then it's automatic death.
Well, but
isn't the fact of mitigation in and of itself a subjective determination? You can have a fact, propose that it's mitigating, and the court may find it's not mitigating and give it no weight.
If it's not absolutely. If there's a threshold finding that it's not mitigation.
So you're saying if the court says this is mitigating,
it has to get onto the scale.
But the only way to not consider it would be to say this is not considered a mitigating factor.
Correct.
Or we find it's not a mitigating factor.
Correct. It once it's determined to be relevant and it should be in the calculus, you know, assigning it zero, you know, 2 + 0 = 2, right? If 0 + 0 = 0, and if you don't give it any weight, then it's not being considered.
Well, it's the court determining that it's not a mitigating factor.
If a court makes a finding that it's not mitigating, then it doesn't make the scale. But what we have here is a court saying this is mitigating evidence, but
I'm
giving it no
weight. And what's the evidence you're talking about that should be given weight?
In this case, it was whether he would be released, whether he would ever get out of prison, is one of the circumstances where the trial court said no weight.
Right, and the argument was he could be in prison for the rest of his life, so that should weigh in the decision on whether the death penalty should be imposed. And the court, by saying we're giving that no weight, means that they don't think that that's a mitigating circumstance is worthy of inclusion.
The trial court's opinion specifically lists this as mitigation that we consider, that, you know, is there. And when it came to the weighing process, it gave it nothing. And our argument is, based on Lockett and Eddings, is that when you assign mitigation nothing, no value, then it can't be considered. It's not making the scale. You know, 0 + 0 = 0. And you can't, you know, Lockett and Eddings says specifically that you can't give mitigation no weight. And I'll provide that on rebuttal. I know I'm way over. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Oster.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, Michael Oster on behalf of the state of Ohio. To try to move for clarity's sake, I'll go through the arguments in the same order as they were addressed by appellant in this case. The first is to the jury waiver in 1984. There's nothing in the record that Judge Brewer's colloquy with the defendant in 1984 was in any way deficient. We have a validly signed waiver from 1984, and when Judge Nastoff went back and reviewed that waiver, he found that all parties were aware that the waiver applied, and that it applied not only to the guilt phase, but also to the sentencing phase. This court has had multiple discussions about the three judges. It's curious, though, to note that throughout the waiver, and especially when Judge Brewer finally signed the waiver, he discusses the panel. Multiple times as well, if you go back to the transcript of that hearing, Judge Brewer is citing the panel, the panel, the three judges. The discussion that there's somehow a vested right in having these three judges simply doesn't hold weight when the evidence is looked at. It's also interesting that when we had the re-sentencing phase, we had a hearing on 8-28 of 08, in which the original defense attorney, Michael Shanks, testified. And part of that testimony, he revealed something that I think is very interesting for this discussion today, which is there were only three general division judges in Butler County at that time. This was not a situation where there was even a roll of three judges or specifically selected three. There were only three judges in Butler County in 1983.
But if one of them had to recuse for some reason, there would have been an assignment by the Supreme Court for a visiting judge for that purpose. So what does that matter?
Well, part of it is it discounts the fact that these were supposedly the only three judges that Mr. Davis wanted, or somehow there was discussion about, well, we rolled, so we have this right to have those three. But also, the Chief Justice's point brings up something that was never discussed as well, which was July 1st of 1973, the criminal rules were promulgated. And what's never been discussed here today is Criminal Rule 25B. Criminal Rule 25B, promulgated at the original time in 1973, talks about the disability of a judge. And when a judge becomes disabled for any reason, another judge may be assigned to take their place. So in this situation, if Judge Stitzinger or Judge Moser had died, in a very unfortunate circumstance in between, there could still be another judge who would replace them. And that was completely contemplated in 1983 and 1984 by Criminal Rule 25B at that time. Part of Mr. Davis's waiver, the second paragraph, which Justice Lansinger referred to, he says that he's waiving these knowing the consequences under Ohio law. Well, in July 1st of 1973, Ohio law was Criminal Rule 25B that it could be replaced. I think it's also important to note that waiver also cites Revised Code Section 2945.06. That section starts out saying any judge, which again discounts the fact that only these three judges could be used for this purpose. What is more, this court has considered this issue before. This court, in the second time that Mr. Davis's case came before this court, in Proposition of Law 5 to this court at that time, it was raised that Mr. Davis didn't understand the distinctions between a panel and three judges and that he should be allowed to withdraw his jury waiver. This court rejected that argument. That rejection by this court makes this issue today barred by the doctrine of res judicata.
Counsel, I'm over here on your right.
Sorry, sir.
That's fine. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what the Sixth Circuit said when they said there's a legitimate question as to whether a defendant should be held to a jury waiver entered almost 25 years before his newly mandated sentencing hearing.
The first thing I would point out is in that decision itself, in the concurrence. The concurrence at the very end states basically that we shouldn't be going to an issue such as that which is rendered moot at this point and trying to be given any advice. And that would be the first argument the state would make in that regard. The second argument I would make is that even in saying that, the Sixth Circuit never gave any contemplation, never cited Revised Code Section 2929.06b, which allows the state of Ohio to impanel a new set of judges. It also did not cite Criminal Rule 25b or really dive into Ohio law. So the state's position on that sentence is it's dicta that wasn't needed because it was actually moot as to their decisions on the issue, and that in no way does that change the state we have here of Ohio law and statutes which can control
this
issue.
I guess what I'm reading into that, and maybe I shouldn't be, but it just seems to me they're saying we have, if you'll excuse the term, a stale waiver. It's a quarter of a century old, and we have new laws.
That might have been part of their contemplation, Your Honor, but I think that it's a halfway contemplated standard because they have not then contemplated the fact that that 29-2906 has come into play in Ohio. They did not contemplate that back in 1973 we still could change.
Was it argued to the Sixth Circuit?
I was no part of that.
The staleness of the waiver or the fact that whether they the waiver was valid any longer was not part of the opinion, the Sixth Circuit's opinion here, other than this dicta that's contained in it.
Correct, Chief Justice.
And so there was no oral argument on it. There was no briefing on it. This is just the musings of the Sixth Circuit
judges.
That is my understanding of that. And only two of them, as obviously the concurrence did not believe that, that any statement of that should be made.
Before you pick up, Mr. Oster, when would the withdrawal of a jury waiver be appropriate in your view?
My view would follow the Ohio Revised Code, which is 2945.05, which says at any time before the commencement of a trial.
And so there's nothing that would authorize the withdrawal in this instance?
No, absolutely nothing in Ohio law. I think appellant's argument here has been based on uniqueness and time.
Actually, the argument's based on fraud in the inducement, because carrying the argument to the logical conclusion, it is the waiver was given for three specific jurists to hear the case, and since the state doesn't have the capacity to do that, I should be permitted to withdraw. That's the argument.
That is, as I think Mr. Comp said, one of their aspects to their argument. However, I think in looking at that, this specific situation, though, these three judges could have been replaced, but also I'll go back to that hearing again on 8-28 of 08, and Mr. Shank specifically testified as to the reason they signed the jury waiver. The main reason were his words, and the reason he says that they withdrew it was not because they wanted these three judges. He said they wanted to keep away from a jury his previous murder conviction and his previous weapons charge because they believed that they couldn't overcome this in front of a jury and that that would be too damning in front of a jury. That's at that hearing on page 25 through 27. So the statement here today that the reason behind this, the main reason was because they wanted three judges, Judge Stichinger, Judge Moser, and Judge Brewer, simply isn't reflected accurately in the record. When the original trial counsel was called in 2008, he gave testimony, obviously clearly now a part of the record before this court, that the main reason they did that was because they had no counter to his previous murder conviction and his weapons charge that they felt they could go in front of a jury with. That was, in his words, the main reason they did this.
Did they have?
He did testify. The defendant did testify during the trial. And he testified that a fellow by the name of Silky was the actual murder. And, you know, obviously, in front of a jury, that would have been very difficult to testify with his record. So this was a very strategic play on behalf of his counsel to allow him to get on the stand and give his version of the facts without suffering the consequences of his record being inflamed or inflammatory in front of a jury.
Correct, Chief Justice. In fact, page 27, Mr. Shank's testimony, yes, this was a trial strategy issue that we all considered. It was a concern for us for sure. And so that is the reason given of why this jury waiver was invoked.
Had the daughter the first murder was of Mr. Davis's wife. Had his daughter forgiven him at that point?
I don't believe so, no, Your Honor.
When did that forgiveness come?
I believe it was Suzette Butler, who is the second victim's daughter, who
second
forgave
victim's
him.
Daughter.
Yes, Your Honor. And one comment I would like to make about that is, and I know we're still in the first issue here, but I think it's an important fact to make that when she does that, her words, I think, are very telling in that the forgiveness was really for her own benefit. It wasn't necessarily for Mr. Davis's or that this was this great mitigating factor. She said very simply on page 100 to 101 that she didn't want to carry it anymore. She didn't want to have to carry that. This forgiveness, this sense of getting that weight off her chest, I think the record clearly reflects that this was done for her benefit, not Mr. Davis's, and that this really wasn't this broad mitigating factor that she had come to know him so well and love him, but that she herself needed to get that off her chest. And I think that's reflected on page 100 and 101.
So you're saying that was a qualified forgiveness? Forgiving for my benefit, but not for yours?
I think it read that way, yes, Your Honor. Another question that was raised here before is the statement of how many times can something come back? What does 292906 contemplate? Is there a second bite at the apple? Is there a third bite at the apple? And something that struck me as I sat at council table was, as you look at 292906, part of what it says under Section B is whenever. And I think that word is telling, because there is no qualifier as to once or twice. It says whenever. And I think the word whenever, and given its ordinary meaning, is very clear, that it's any time this happens, whenever this occurs, this procedure is to be used.
Counsel, that brings me to, if I may move you on to a new subject.
Yes, Your Honor.
The matter before the court today is our independent review of mitigation. And what maybe confuses me more than others is we now have somebody who's been in prison for a quarter of a century. Is the fact that somebody is a model prisoner, are they in fact getting further removed from their crime, and is that relevant evidence that I must look at?
I believe it is relevant evidence you must look at, especially under such cases like Skipper from the U.S. Supreme Court. And I do believe Coyle v. Davis, which sent this case back, says that that would be at least a relevant mitigating piece of evidence to be put in front of a judge or a three-judge panel. I apologize. But I think what's important to note, though, and that draws us straight into this Eddings-Steffen argument. And what's important to note is the defense can put forth evidence they believe is mitigating to the judge. And especially in Ohio, as we have the B7, commonly known as the catch-all factor, there's wide latitude given to defendants to put forth this evidence. But because you can put forth what you as a defendant believe is mitigating under a catch-all, under the catch-all statute, B7, doesn't mean that the judges have to find that it mitigates or somehow lessens your culpability for the crime. So because you put forth this evidence does not mean that it has to be given weight. And Steffen clearly says that. In fact, Steffen gives an example. Steffen gives the example of a high school teacher who comes forth and says, well, he was always a very well-prepared student and well-behaved. But this court in Steffen said, the jury or the court may assign absolutely no weight to this evidence if it considers it to be non-mitigating. Evidence can be put forth. Evidence can be considered by a court. But if that evidence does not mitigate guilt, does not lessen a person's moral culpability for a crime, it can be assigned no weight. The appellant in citing Eddings actually cuts a sentence in Eddings in half. Eddings at page 114 to 115, the quote is, may not give it, meaning relevant mitigating evidence, no weight. And that's where appellant stops. But the sentence doesn't have a period there. The sentence, when read in its entirety, says, may not give it no weight by excluding such evidence from their consideration. So to have an actual violation of Eddings, the trial court would have had to say, Ms. Mauser, you're not allowed to testify about these issues. They would have had to say, we don't want to necessarily hear about these cost issues, we won't do it. But instead, the trial court here allowed the defense to get all the evidence in. Under the catch-all. And in fact, in the sentencing decision on page 4 and 5, the trial court lists all this evidence. It's clear that they considered it because they state why they gave it no evidence. And when it comes to Ms. Mauser, they stated it was highly speculative and unconvincing.
So by the fact that they assigned no weight to this is indicative of the fact that they heard it, they considered it, and then they assigned a value to it. And it is just the opposite of what would occur, what would need to occur in order to say that legitimate mitigating evidence was not considered. And we have cases that have said that, you know, the court failed to consider this mitigating evidence. Their silence on it in the sentencing entry, we interpret to indicate that. But here, by specifically referring to it and giving it no value, no weight, it's clear that they did consider it.
Yes.
Counsel, is it a semantic argument then that is made by defense counsel when he says if it's considered or if it's labeled mitigating, you have to give it some weight?
Yes. Yes, it is, Your Honor. Because There's wide latitude when you consider mitigating evidence, but that does not mean it mitigates the crime. Mitigating the crime takes away a moral culpitude or lessens the appropriateness of the death sentence. Something that's highly speculative or unconvincing or really can't even be applied. I mean, Ms. Mauser could not say how long Mr. Davis would spend in prison. She couldn't. As much as the defense tried, she couldn't say that. She couldn't say who the parole board would consist of. She couldn't say she had enough information. She said, without all that information, I can't even formulate an opinion as to what would happen. It's really almost beyond understanding how that could be given weight, because there's no statement from Ms. Mauser that in any way really would contemplate what would happen in Mr. Davis's case. She simply couldn't say, not by fault of her own, but by the process of how the Ohio Parole Board serves. And so when the judges gave that an assessment, when they looked at it, when they heard the testimony, when they went through and said, look, we find this unconvincing, highly speculative, because that satisfied Eddings. They gave it consideration. They didn't strike it from their consideration. And so really what it is a game of semantics, but also cutting what I'd consider the core sentence here in the Eddings case that this court needs to consider in half.
Counsel, the I assume you've thought a lot about the practicalities involved in this unique case. This defendant is in this situation in which there are additional factors to be presented or were presented in mitigation, because his lawyers have been successful in battling the conviction in the first place. But we're now almost 30 years out from the offense. The daughter, were there more siblings, or were there just a single daughter?
There was two daughters from the second murder of Suzette Butler, Your Honor.
So one of the daughters has indicated that she's forgiven this defendant. We're here, and assuming this court affirms, probably looking at another, 10 years of federal litigation?
Probably at least.
Fair guess on that part?
Yeah, although I don't do very much federal, I think that's a very fair guess.
And then once that all comes to an end, we're now in a situation where, because the governor and others don't seem to want to execute more than 6 or 7 people a year, that they're parked waiting, those who have exhausted all their appeals. So you add on another 3 years, basically, now. So we're talking another 13 years. So now we'd be arguably 43 years out from the crime. Doesn't that in itself, shouldn't that be something we think about, and whether or not it makes sense to go on with the death penalty in this individual's unique circumstance?
There's two answers to that. The first is, under the Newton case in this court's decision, each sentencer obviously is allowed to weigh in their own discretion. So standing here before you today, I can't tell you how you necessarily should do it.
I'm asking a philosophical question rather than...
And I guess under my philosophy, which I'll support with case law, I would say no. It is not something that... because it doesn't lessen his culpability for the crime. It doesn't diminish what he did. And it doesn't diminish his aggravating circumstance, which is that he's killed two women in his previous murder of his wife. And then he gets paroled, and then he kills less than 3 years later his estranged girlfriend. And I would also back that up in a recent denial of cert, Chief Justice Thomas.
Well, isn't the death penalty about retribution on behalf of the state? And once it's so far removed from the crime, How does that make sense?
Well, I believe that, philosophically speaking, as people, we're bound to the decisions we make. The passage of time doesn't necessarily mean that we have tabula rasa, that we have a blank slate anymore, that our decisions didn't matter. When we make decisions, we teach our children constantly, you have to live with those decisions. We teach them that there are consequences for those. And to say to Mr. Davis, well, because you've kept arguing against this, and because you've kept arguing against this, we're going to take away a consequence, even though the law says this is fine, even though we have a procedure in the state of Ohio, to tell him you just get a consequence taken away because of time, I don't think honors the law, and I don't think honors the fact that he made that choice, and that there are two daughters out there that we've discussed that live with that choice. And so I think it's greater than just the passage of time. I think we've cited cases in that section of our brief that deal with whether spending an amount of time on death row, and no case has ever found that that is a reason to justify that out. And Justice Thomas, in his concurrence in a denial of cert, simply said it would actually make a mockery of our justice system to say that someone can keep pressing on in their appeals and then we allow them to go away. And so the state would assert that those cases, as well as Your Honor's question went a little bit philosophical, and the philosophical statement that the state would assert is simply that you have to live with the consequences of your action, and time doesn't necessarily make that a blank slate.
Because there's no statute of limitations on a crime such as this, I think leans towards the philosophy that the passage of time really is not. He could, if he was just discovered at this point for this murder, even though he had led a law-abiding life since the murder, he would still be culpable for the capital offense here, correct?
Absolutely, Chief Justice. Murder not having a statute of limitations, some of the other things we see now with cold case homicides where people are brought back and held to their actions 20, 30 years beforehand, I think does ring true to the fact that people have to answer for those consequences. So I think that's another point that definitely rings in favor of holding Mr. Davis to that. Your Honors, the state would just go back to a couple of the other issues just to make sure they are covered here. One of the issues we'd go back to, and we would simply assert, we filed the case of State v. White as supplemental authority in this case. Obviously, the 12th District, when they rendered their decision, did not have the benefit of State v. White. But we would say that State v. White is a contemplated jury trial under 29-2906. Both provisions B and E answered the questions as to the retroactivity and the ex post facto clause. And we would assert that that would ring true here as well for Mr. Davis's case. And international law, I think that this court has covered international law in a multitude of cases. The United States, when it ratified certain treaties, expressly held out Provision 7, which allows it to use state and national laws to invoke the death penalty. And so the United States is not bound by some of those national some of those international treaties. This court, we've cited, I think, 5-6 cases to this court of its own jurisdiction that have said that is true and that the state can go through that statement. Your Honor, I still have 5 minutes. However, I believe that the multitude and the bulk of what I wanted to cover here today has been covered. I think the case boils down very simply to the fact that Mr. Davis executed a valid jury waiver in 1984. This court has decided in 1992 that waiver was valid. And the issue in Proposition Law 5 that this court decided was he didn't understand the distinctions between the three-judge panel and the jury. That's the exact issue he's trying to bring back, is the distinctions and what they could cause. And so we think that issue is barred by res judicata. The weighing process was done properly in accord with Steffen and accord with the full sentence in Eddings. State v. White would control the constitutional questions.
Could I ask you a question on that? That's the Penix situation. Is that the situation that the majority of the court found that the defendant could not get the benefit of a life sentence without parole? That, because of the retroactivity, or kind of remind us about that one, because that one is of concern to me.
The State v. Penix case itself?
Yes.
Okay, State v. Penix discussed the fact that you could not, before the implementation by the Ohio General Assembly of 292906, that you could not necessarily re-impanel a jury to do a capital sentencing. However, this court in the Davis case, when it came before this court, in its decision in 1992, found that Penix itself didn't apply to a three-judge panel situation. And so Penix was not applied to Mr. Davis's case.
Although the real impetus of that case, was it not that you could not sentence to death once it was reversed? You had to sentence to a life term afterwards.
I would disagree that that was the whole crux of the Penix case at that time. And I think that this court was able to consider that in 1992 and didn't find that that was the case as well. What is more is that obviously was overruled by the General Assembly in enacting 292906. The State v. White case would control here today what we have. And I would note, Justice Lanzinger, that you did dissent in State v. White. However, your dissent in State v. White is for reasons that
I
would
found
not...
that White, that it didn't apply the
correct
particular statute. But it is of concern, I think.
Because,
I mean, we talk about the rule of lenity for certain things, and I know in your brief you dispute that the rule of lenity applies here. But when you have a change in statute that basically says, you know, now we have a life without parole statute, and if we have a vacation of the guilt and a resentencing, rather, if we have a resentencing, the resentencing must be for life without parole. You don't get to impose a death penalty for the second time.
And the reason we disagree with the rule of lenity is because the rule of lenity contemplates when there's either an ambiguity in the statute or two statutes are in conflict with one another. And in this case, there simply aren't statutes that are ambiguous or conflict with one another. And so to kind of take the rule of lenity and say that it becomes more than that, that it just becomes something almost like appellant would like to argue, well, it's been a long time and this is unique, so let's just invoke the rule of lenity because of circumstances. That's not really what the rule of lenity is providing for. It's when there's ambiguity in those statutes or a conflict between the two. In either of those situations, it can apply, but it's not meant to apply just because something is unique or has gone on for a number of years, which is why we disagree with that statement that they're making here. Not that I don't understand necessarily where Your Honor's coming from, but again, it's the rule is there for that specific purpose and doesn't really contemplate into this.
We talk about retroactivity, and we say that you can't increase a penalty, ex post facto. And you're saying correspondingly the defendant does not get the benefit retroactively.
The penalty in 1983 was death. The penalty in 2009 was death. There is no increase in punishment. That would be the third Calder factor under ex post facto. And it would be the first question that this court asked in State v. White of itself when it looked at, is this substantive or remedial? The court said, does this increase punishment? And the court in White simply stated no. It was death before, it's death now.
Except now, if the death penalty is vacated once, you can't impose it again.
Currently under 292906, you would be able to impose the death penalty again as long as the error occurred in the sentencing phase with either a jury trial or a three-judge panel. Mm-hmm. And so that's why 292906 is very clear and unambiguous, which takes it out of the rule of lenity, and it allows, from its first enactment, it allows both the jury and the three-judge panel, as long as the error occurred during a sentencing phase, and you're within those time parameters, it does allow to be reconstituted and for the death penalty to be reimposed as long as it was on the books. Where you'd get in trouble, and the supplemental authority that the appellant filed was the Pew case. I see I'm out of time.
Go ahead.
That supplemental authority, where you would get in trouble is if currently we had the death penalty, but in 1983 it was, say, life without the possibility of parole. You would get in trouble and violate the ex post facto and retroactivity if you then just went to what's on the books now and did death. And that's why we countered the supplemental authority with the Sturgis and the Curley case, which have found that there aren't those situations and pews inapplicable when you go to what was on the books at that time.
And you're saying the error did occur in the sentencing phase?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I think all parties agree that the error occurred in the sentencing phase. As I'm out of time, I would just ask that this court affirm the sentence imposed upon Mr. Davis. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Comp, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. The quote is from the Sixth Circuit, and Mike read it all, and it states, The sentencer may determine the weight to be given relevant mitigating evidence, but may not give it no weight by excluding such evidence from their consideration.
By excluding, and here by mentioning it, they're saying we considered it and we gave it no weight.
But if it has no weight on the scale, and I point in our brief, and I didn't mention it the first time I was up, Porter versus McCollum discusses you can't reduce mitigation to inconsequential proportions, and by giving it no weight, I think once you say it gets on the scale, you have to give it something. It's important. There was a statement that that the individual who had a reconciliation forgave Mr. Davis didn't relate to the underlying aggravating circumstance. That was the daughter of the victim, which was the aggravating circumstance. And that's critical because if you look at trial counsel's testimony, which the state asked this court to look at, he indicated that, you know, if we had different mitigation, we may have come to a different conclusion. So what they're trying to do is keep us, as I think Justice O'Neill said, to a stale waiver based on facts known in 1984, when the facts known today, trial counsel from 1984 said they would give a different answer to that question.
But do you disagree that your client, the aim of the defense at the time was to allow your client to take the stand and give his testimony that there was a third person present who actually pulled the trigger?
The aim of the defense at the time of the guilt phase?
When your client testified.
When our client testified, yes, they had him testify.
And it would have been pretty difficult to have him testify in front of a jury knowing that he was a convicted murderer and was up for a second murder.
Absolutely, but that sort of demonstrates my point. We're going back for a new sentencing, so there's a new calculus as to what should occur. If we're going to say this is what happened in 1984 and that's it, that ignores the second half of trial counsel's testimony that said if I had this mitigation that you have now, it would be a completely different picture because I would have the victim from that first crime as a mitigating witness,
the daughter. One of the victims.
Correct. To say I have a reconciliation, I've given him forgiveness, and I hope to continue this relationship with him. That's the nature of her testimony. It wasn't, I forgave him, for my own thing. It was they're having an ongoing, building a relationship and having true reconciliation and remorse. And that is very powerful mitigation, and it changes the calculus when you're deciding whether to waive a jury or go to a three-judge panel.
Thank you.
We'll
take the matter under advisement. Gentlemen, you'll be notified of our decision.